recently the author of The Street Sweeper. Elliot, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you, Edward. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So I understand that you lived in New York at some point after the publication of Seven Types of Ambiguity. I also understand that you did, in fact, reside across the street from Memorial Sloan Kettering. How long did you live out here? I'm curious. Did you have to live in a place to write about it? What's up with this?
Well, I was, I've been to New York as a tourist, but the first time I ever went there, you know, with a view to considering, you know, making it part of my life was back in about 98. Mm-hmm. I was on a, I was coming home from the UK. I'd done a book tour in the UK for my first novel, $3, and some friends of mine said, you know, would you like to swing by New York on your way home? And of course, it gives you a sense of just how far Australia is from so much of the rest of the world that we consider the US and the UK the same neighborhood. And so I said, yes, definitely. And that became, that sort of begun a romance with the city. And actually, it began a romance with a New York girl or woman, I should say.
Uh-huh.
This led me to visit New York for the next 5 years, 3 or 4 times a year. Mm-hmm. And after that 5-year period, I ended up moving there, and I lived in New York for 4 years.
Oh.
And the first place that we lived, you know, even when I in the 5-year period was opposite Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And look, I don't know that, you know, one has to live somewhere in order to write about it. In fact, I would say probably you don't. But in my case, and it wasn't a conscious thing; it was more. You know, while sort of feeling like a New Yorker increasingly, I think the thing is, and this is what I hadn't realized when I first went there as a tourist, you know, the city is overwhelming in so many senses, not merely because of its size, but it stimulates, you know, pretty much all your senses frequently at once. And I think the way to try to make New York your friend is to realize that it's a sprawling city of many diverse neighborhoods. And so I started to become, you know, comfortable with the neighborhood that I was living in at the time. And, of course, directly across the street from me was Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And, in fact, in order to get anywhere west, I would take the bus or walk. And the bus stop that was closest to me that would take me, you know, in a westerly direction across Manhattan was immediately outside the hospital. And so I got to see regularly this, you know, people are used to hearing that New York is a microcosm of the world. Well, this Sloan Kettering Cancer Center is really a microcosm of New York, particularly Manhattan, because you've got people from all different walks of life and all different ethnicities and races and socioeconomic backgrounds going there because the hospital, it takes up a city block, and it's not merely a hospital for treating cancer patients. It does research, and it has outreach programs to you know, high school students, and it does all sorts of things. It's like a veritable city, and I would see people spilling out onto the sidewalk in all different states of anxiety, including people that work there, and frequently they would start smoking, you know, because they were stressed, which is kind of ironic. And you know, I got to know some of the people, at least by face, that were regularly there. And, you know, that sort of started stimulating the what-if questions that so often lead somebody that is thinking of writing something to actually go ahead and write it. And, you know, that was the what-if an unlikely friendship were to blossom. And that's where the first relationship, one of the more pivotal relationships in The Street Sweeper developed between an African-American probationary janitor in what the cancer center calls building services, and he befriends an elderly Jewish Holocaust survivor that has been mistakenly left on the sidewalk and is desperately looking for a way to get back up to his room. And that's where the novel begins, and that's sort of where I began. And I suppose in the larger sense, you know, if you you grow up so enthralled by and in awe of New York, you wonder as any kind of creative person, because so much has been written about it in fiction and non-fiction and indeed in poetry, so many movies have been made about it and television shows, you wonder, is there a spare inch for me as a creative person? Can I, you know, or has it already been entirely colonized by other people's imaginations? And I sort of fell upon this because I was living across the street from there, and that sort of made me think, well, you know, I could write about this. And, well, and that's where it started, really. But I don't think one needs to live where they're writing about.
Well, you happen to be talking with a New Yorker, a Brooklynite who does quite a deal of prodigious walking, so I know this city fairly well. And I do have to remark upon a few aspects of New York in your novel that made me count not necessarily a discerning eye, but more of a curious observation. For example, near the end, you have the mayor of East 77th in York, which is close to John Jay Park, and in that area, you'll have a three-bedroom going for $3,600. Not exactly a place for the working poor, the working class to be. You have two characters in their 30s.
I gotta correct you there.
Oh?
It's not East 77th. It's East 86th or 87th, I think.
It said 77th in the copy I have. So, well, the other thing, too, is... Go ahead.
Sorry, I haven't let you ask that question properly.
Oh, yeah. Well, also, you have two characters in their 30s who are listening to Jonathan Schwartz. And let me assure you, Elliot, that no 30-something I know is especially fond of Schwartz's interminable asides between the songs. but I'm wondering, though, I thought that maybe this might be possibly your own answer to Kafka having the Statue of Liberty with a sword instead of a torch, whether verisimilitude in some sense actually is a drawback, especially when you have a sprawling social canvas with which that you're working off of, and you're already following multiple trails of breadcrumbs and trying to keep that great, I suppose, all those multiple trails kind of in some sort of cohesive, massive narrative that makes sense. So what of this?
Well, you know, at the risk of people now sort of going to look for mistakes that I've made, I have attempted to get it right. And, you know, for example, that character that you referred to as the mayor, this is a man I saw and knew and had conversations with for people that hadn't read the book. This is a man who works for the MTA, and he sort of supervises the buses as they arrive at what is either the last stop going east or the first stop going back west. And I had the experience, you know, as a tourist that was frequently in the same place, and then as a nascent New Yorker, that this man would see me and make eye contact with me and then have conversations with me. Mm-hmm. And it made you feel like you had become part of the neighborhood. And then I read about him in the Times, and that's where he was called the mayor. You know, the mayor, not of the city, not of a borough, but of a city block. And so I decided to refer to him that way. In fact, I'd love to get a copy of the book to him. I hope he's doing well. I think he's retired now. I'll try to keep tabs on him all the way from Melbourne, Australia. But so that was an attempt at, you know, verisimilitude, and the reference to the Greenwich Village apartment prices. Well, that was in the very early 60s. That character is paying something like, you know, $40 a week for a fifth floor walk up or something. So, you know, I've attempted to get that right. I might be wrong, but the attempt is to get it right. So, I guess in answer to your question, Kafka can get away with things that I didn't feel I could. And because I had spent so much time in New York, I was trying to get it right. But, you know, you might well find things that I've got wrong.
Well, let's talk about this research and the social canvas here. I mean, this book, it deals with the Holocaust. You have mid-20th century developments in American labor. You have a man who just got out of jail. You have the nature of history. You have the Great Migration. You have the academic world. You have the adjective-verb quotient ratio and wire recording involving Dr. Border, and I'll get into that a little bit more and into a bit. So it's almost a kitchen sink book, or perhaps, if you want to pay homage to James Pearson, an Anything You Want book. I know that many of these elements came to you by serendipity, as you just said, and in other interviews, but I'm wondering how much you need to have these thematic connections worked out in advance. I mean, can you really deal with a novel when you have a scale that is this large, both with this and also with seven types? I mean, were there any things that you threw out along the way, or...?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. I know you hear a lot of writers say that they invent characters and the characters, you know, grab them by the ear and take them along to the conclusion of the book. And I think that's often true, but I think sometimes it's not true. They say it, and perhaps it sounds romantic or in some way interesting. I'm not like that. I'm anxious and anal retentive, and particularly with the last two books, The Street Sweeper and Seven Types of Ambiguity, I needed to know how they were going to end before I got too far into them, and pretty much actually at the beginning, I think, even with Seven Types. And I'm probably that way with pretty much everything I write, except maybe some short stories. But, you know, the danger is that you spend years of your life writing this thing, and that the end doesn't satisfy you. And that would be a tragedy for me. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that the endings of those two books will satisfy everybody, but they need to satisfy me before I'm willing to commit. You know, what it's really been, I mean, Seven Types of Ambiguity took almost 4 years to write, and this one took about, The Street Sweeper took about 5.5 years. So, you know, you want to be satisfied that at least I think it's a story worth telling. So I do plan it out quite meticulously. And, of course, what happens is it gets enriched by your research along the way. And, you know, there are certain things that don't help you, so you are, you know, less inclined to use them. But if there are certain things that do help you, then, you know, obviously you grab it, and it might look like you've been building to that along the way. But it's really it's a combination of having the architecture or the spine of the thing worked out with certain key points that you've already researched. But then there are certain little things that you find serendipitously that you know, can be incredibly helpful. And they go in, and it might look like you knew that all along, when in fact you didn't come to that until a bit later.
Well, speaking of serendipity, I was curious about this. I mean, can you entirely avoid coincidences or convenient run-ins or contrivances with your method? I mean, aren't there certain strands where you kind of have to... the bandage is not exactly neatly applied to the wound, or how does this work?
Well, you know, some people have said that I've used coincidence. I can't even remember which book it was, or maybe it's more than one book. I guess I try not to overdo it, but I have a little fondness for it, and maybe it's because in certain senses I'm a child of the 19th century in terms of the stuff that was important to me.
Yeah.
As a young man growing up, and you know, I try not to use it as much as it was used by some of my heroes, because I don't think, you know, in the 21st century a writer can probably get away with it in the same way as, you know, a filmmaker probably couldn't make something as beautifully sweet as It's a Wonderful Life. As much as we all might love that movie, if somebody literally tried to make that now, it would probably not be revered anywhere near as much, because society is so different from the society that came to, firstly, the society in which it was made.
And well, how so? Is it because of sincerity?
It's a Wonderful Life now. We're cutting it some slack because of the time it was made.
Mm-hmm.
So we might cut, and I hope we do, cut so many of the 19th century greats some slack for coincidences that I might not be cut now. But having said that, you know, I do use it a little bit, but, you know, whether I overuse it or not is probably for readers to decide. I hope I don't. I try not to.
You know, that's a very crafty way of suggesting that contemporary fiction is perhaps not getting enough slack for depicting certain realities. Is that what you were suggesting, Mr. Perlman?
look, I'm probably not being crafty. I'm probably being, you know, sleep deprived and not expressing myself eloquently. But look, I don't know. I mean, I had the feeling in the 90s, at least, that we had perhaps become almost too cynical and too, too cynical, a little bit too clever in the sense of it's all very well to delineate, even meticulously, what it is that you're thoroughly over, what it is that you're disenchanted by, but sooner or later, shouldn't art remind us what we would really aspire to? And the danger with doing that, you know, is that you're wearing your heart on your sleeve and you make yourself an easy target and, you know, super hip, you know, ultra-literate people, they can be more interested and get more pleasure out of, you know, deriding the status quo than perhaps dreaming or aspiring to something a little better. And I take the risk, you know, whether it's successful or not, I don't know, but probably in all, certainly the three novels that I've written so far, and I think even in some of the short stories, by trying to offer some hope. And, I do that because that's what I would like.
Yeah. You know, Elliot, another way of phrasing this might just be this. I mean, I'm curious if from the vantage point of Australia, you, as a novelist, were under siege with this wave that was against, you know, sincerity in fiction and against postmodernism in fiction, and that especially the last two novels are partially a response to that. I mention this because I note that sometimes in your fiction, you were very fond of saying you in a way that is rather curious. It's not quite a second person and it's not quite omniscient. It's somewhere in between, and I'm fascinated by that. There are also these strange moments often in your novels where you will often almost command the reader. And I can get into that in a little bit. I mean, one thing I think of is pay attention to the small details. It is the mark of a professional. That whole business with Adam Zygmelic. And I'm curious if this is has plagued you in any way, or how this curious, not quite omniscient, but also leaving room for taking on perspective developed.
That particular example that you brought up, Edward, is actually, well, it's a device, really. It's Adam, who is a historian at Columbia, an insecure, untenured historian who is certain that his time at Columbia is just about up because he hasn't written anything new for 5 years. Mm. And he is delivering a lecture to his undergraduate students. So when he says things like, pay attention, it's the character talking to his students. You might also say, well, that's the author talking to his readers. It doesn't need to be taken that way, but yeah. Look, I suppose I can't hide the fact that I feel certain things quite strongly, and it's so difficult writing anything that you may as well write something that you believe in and that matters to you, and clearly, you know, I guess I put my heart on my sleeve with my political views with all of the books, and in doing that, you know, sometimes perhaps I can be overly prescriptive. I don't think it would have bothered me as a reader, and that's why I put it in there. I suppose if somebody has particularly views that are really antithetical to mine, diametrically opposed, then they're going to be annoyed by what might appear finger-waving, but at the very least, I do it in the context of a character talking to other characters. look at me, I'm sort of trying to trawl through my memory of all the negative things that have been said about me in an attempt to bend over backwards to help you. Isn't that pathetic? It has been said that I can be didactic at times. Again, it's a question of degree, and obviously, when I hit the send button and it's sent to editors, I think that it's not overly didactic. It's
let me clarify. I mean, and I think that the What is History chapter is one of the most interesting points in the book. I mean, you have this situation where Adam is describing the personal tidbits of Gandhi, Dietrich Bonhoeffer befriending this black man over the Union Theological Seminary, and things like that. So in that moment, you do in fact write, not in Adam's words, but those of the narrator, that pay attention to the small details. But I thought that it wasn't necessarily a command, it was more of a cue to the readers, but it also made me think, well, I wonder if he's actually up to some larger game to encourage readers to look almost beyond your book, to look at the sources you have in the back, or whether this was some modest gesture to postmodernism where you basically just thought the whole thing was kind of a wild game, or there was perhaps a genuine interest on your part over whether history could in fact predict the future. But it sounds to me like what you're saying is that that was driven from a pure moment of emotional sincerity, and that's pretty much how you operate, and this may explain some of the things I'm observing from your book, these very visceral, heightened moments couched in really unusual philosophical terms?
Well, you ask excellent questions. I didn't mean to say that because you already decided to interview me, but you really do. And I hope that in my, you know, sleep-deprived state, I'm able to do justice to them. I guess what I'm trying to do, I think, is marry a certain passion that makes you want to write in the first place, because it is, in so many respects, an irrational activity. I mean, you're alone, you're frequently not particularly physically comfortable, and you're never going to be adequately financially rewarded for all the hours it takes you to produce the thing. So, you know, and it's sort of, for the most part, an antisocial thing to do. So, in that respect, it's an irrational activity. So, why are you doing it? You're doing it because something in you would feel worse if you didn't do it. And it's a kind of a passion, and you really want to grab the reader and hold him or her and say, you know, look at this, look at this story, look at the world, at least as I see it. And yet, you've got to impose some kind of order on it. And that's where the sort of other side of me, I suppose, the anal retentive side, the side that, you know, became a lawyer, or maybe it was fostered and assisted and nurtured by being a lawyer. Anyway, leaving aside any attempts to psychoanalyze myself on a long distance call, it is a marriage of the two: the passion, but the attempt to impose some order over it, and in a sense, the structure of the book is where I'm definitely using more intellect than emotion, but then within the pockets, there is an attempt to really say to the reader, yeah, you know, look at this. I mean, I'm thinking about it. Would you like to think about it too? And I'll try to express it as eloquently as I can to get you to see things, or at least contemplate things from the perspective I have it. When it's a character that, you know, shares what could be essentially described as a series of views that constitute my worldview. But often, you know, particularly in certain types, I might be writing from characters that definitely don't share my views. But even then, you try to, as much as you can, imbue them with every bit of humanity that you can garner, to make the suggestion ultimately that there is more that we have in common that separates us. And if we can just put aside so much of our preconceptions, we might get along a little better. But, I mean, that runs the risk of making it sound like literature is a tool for social cohesion only. And you know, it isn't. It does many things. And that's only one of the things it can do, and it frequently doesn't do that. So I don't want to make, you know, too many claims for what I'm trying to do, but I don't think it is, and I am getting back to your question, I promise, I don't think it is a kind of a postmodern device or trick on my part. I don't have a great deal of sympathy for postmodernism in writing when it's carried to excess. And the evidence of that is my little tirade on it in the middle of Seven Types of Ambiguity.
Yeah.
I think it masks a lot of sloppy thinking.
But at the same time, I mean, I think, at least from based off of reading your books and based off of talking with you, it seems that despite the fact that you do an incredible amount of research, I mean, seven types of ambiguity, talking with sex workers, in this case, interviewing various employees of Memorial Sloan Kettering. I mean, this is interesting because when you end up writing your novel, you end up gravitating more towards the visceral, and it becomes not so much about what you have dug up through your research, and it becomes more about what you're trying to express, just as you have said right now. And I'm curious, I mean, on some level, I think we can both agree all novelists are professional liars. I mean, your sole obligation, really, is to persuade people to believe in your story. So I have to wonder, Elliot, why this concrete base with which to pursue some universe or some massive social novel?
Oh, I think, you know, because the issues are so important, you know, the larger ones being obviously civil rights history and also the Holocaust, I really feel more than I ever have before in the previous books an obligation to get it right, because they're such important issues. But then even in a smaller degree, you know, the minute details of New York I've tried to get right, and of course the details of Poland and you know, Auschwitz. There are so many non-fiction books, histories and memoirs written about Auschwitz. You would think I wouldn't have to have gone there six times. But I did go there six times in order to get the comfort. If that doesn't sound too perverse to talk about getting comfort in Auschwitz, but to, as a writer, to be comfortable, to have the confidence to at least tackle writing about people that were there at that time. And so I guess, you know, and I'm figuring this out as you ask me the questions, and that's probably because of the quality of the questions, but yeah, I need the ground beneath my feet as a starting point in order to access the emotions, perhaps. I say perhaps because I'm just I'm figuring out as we talk, but that might be it.
Yeah. But I mean, like, for example, there's the "Memory is a Willful Dog" paragraph that is later in the book. Just to offer a small sample, "Memory is a willful dog. It won't be summoned or dismissed, but it cannot survive without you. It can sustain you or feed on you. It visits when it is hungry, not when you are." Now, these are definitely striking, visceral observations, but I'm curious why you associate memory in this instance purely with dichotomies. I mean, I could dig up Daniel Schachter's really interesting book, The Seven Sins of Memory, in which he describes memories that are often at odds with each other, blocking, misattributing, falling prey to persistence, things like that. I mean, memory is more than duality, so why in this instance stick with sets of two? Is it something that is just the viscerally right thing for you to do at that particular point? Is it a concern for maintaining a relationship with a reader who will go along this variegated, epic journey with you? What? Why does something like that happen?
Well, I agree with the quote that you just read. Was it Schachter?
No, that was from your own book, "The Memory is a Willful Dog." I was reading from your book.
No, not my quote.
Oh, but what I was talking about was Schachter. Yes, exactly.
Yes. I agree with that. No, I guess in this, I certainly don't think that they're sort of, you know, binary opposites all the time. I think the reason I wanted to start the book, and I use that paragraph again later, is to suggest that we really don't have control of our memory. And in fact, you know, memories can be welcome or they can be, you know, terribly dangerous. And we can wish that they weren't there. You can have recurring memories that you wish you didn't have. And then there can be memories that if you could just recover them, they might make you feel a hell of a lot better about your past, your childhood, something that happened to you at school or something with your parents or your siblings or a lover or something. And you think, hey, wait a minute, they didn't hate me that much after all. I forgot about that. Or, you know, perhaps you might have a tendency to hang on to the worst aspects, or some people have a tendency to hang on to the positive, and which can lead them to not learn from the terrible things that might have happened to them before. So, I really just wanted to suggest that, you know, nuisances, and they can sometimes even attack you. So I guess that's what I was trying to suggest there.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you wanted to write about civil rights and the Holocaust because these were of vital importance to you. With the Holocaust, I'm wondering if you considered the problems of Holocaust book fatigue or even Godwin's Law at any time during writing this novel. I mean, there's been so much written about the Holocaust in particular that, as some Holocaust historians have said, the second generation of Holocaust historians have had to up the ante a bit and raise the provocative nature of their arguments and their chronicles. So did you face anything along these lines with the Street Sweeper?
Oh, look, I knew that. I'm very much aware of what might be called Holocaust fatigue. And, to an extent, I hope I don't suffer from that, because the book is not solely about the Holocaust. It's about a lot more than that. But also, the other thing is, I have the view that many people, a tremendous number of people, think they know about the Holocaust, but they don't. And what they are familiar with are certain images, the imagery that we got immediately from largely US, but sometimes I think UK, newsreel photographers. And at the end of the war, Eisenhower told the media to come in and film this stuff because it wasn't going to be believed, and if it wasn't captured on film. And you know, we have all seen the almost dead people walking along, being helped by somebody that's in better shape, a walking skeleton, Muzzlemen as they were called in the camps. And we've all seen the people in the striped uniforms that look like striped pajamas. And we've all seen the bulldozers of corpses being shoveled into ditches. And that, we think, is the Holocaust. And we think, and even well-meaning, sympathetic people think, yeah, well, I've done that. I know about that. That was terrible. But I know about it. And in fact, they don't. They are surprisingly ignorant of it. And so I came to the view that people are perhaps awash with the imagery, but starved of the facts. People have no idea. I mean, people don't know, for example, that, you know, Auschwitz, with its over more than 40 sub-camps, occupied an area just under half, slightly less than half the size of Manhattan. You know, that's an incredible thing to think, that this institution that was created to house slave laborers and to manufacture corpses, mainly of Jews, occupied an area of, you know, half the size of Manhattan. It's stunning. So, you know, I mean, I just chose that fact at random, but there is so much that people don't know, including Jews, who think they know about it. So, in a sense, while being aware of the existence of this this notion of Holocaust fatigue, I don't think that the facts I'm dealing with are too known. They're probably insufficiently known by the average reader. And in terms of just the suggestion that the book deals with the Holocaust triggering a wave of Holocaust fatigue and sending readers away, I'm hopeful it doesn't do that, because the book is not solely about the Holocaust. So, you know.
The issue, I think, is not necessarily to downplay the Holocaust by any means, but there is a reason why Ricky Gervais, in Extras, sent up the notion of the Holocaust movie, and why Holocaust novels, even those that deal partially with the Holocaust, not exclusively with it, are often given second-tier status because, oh no, not another Holocaust novel status. Were you concerned about any labels or anything along those lines? I mean, surely you had to be. You obviously had these very incredible emotions towards the Holocaust, but on the other hand, you're dealing with a marketplace that may in some sense be both embracing your move while also having a reading public simultaneously resistant. Was this ever an issue? Or
it never really occurred to me that the reading public would be resistant, because I've dealt with the civil rights movement and the Holocaust. I mean, because it deals so much with contemporary characters as well, and people who face issues in early 21st century, mainly quiet, I guess I should be terrified.
Yeah.
But I, to be honest, I wasn't. I think because I was just so fueled by the desire to tell this story. And the further you get into it, into my research, and, you know, I had a lot of encouragement by somebody that became a friend of mine who was, in fact, I met him as a guide at the Auschwitz State Museum in Poland. And I told him, and practically, and he was just about the only person I told, the rough outline of the plot. And he said, you have to tell this. And this guy was, you know, younger than me and not Jewish, and in fact Polish. And it served as a tremendous comfort to me. Now, you know, I don't know his reading habits, but I thought, yeah, I really do. I have to tell this story. I really have to tell this story. And even if it means that I don't sell any books and, you know, I have to go back to practicing law, I will have done what I wanted to do. Because, I mean, I keep coming back to the point that it's such a difficult thing to do, to write anything. I'm not even talking about whether you've written it at all well.
Yeah.
To spend so long on your own is, you know, at least superficially, an irrational pursuit. So you may as well write something that really means a lot to you. And this meant a hell of a lot to me. Obviously, the Holocaust did, because I'm Jewish, and my grandparents came from Eastern Europe in the late 20s to Australia, and had they not, we wouldn't be talking now, and they lost pretty much everybody. So, yeah, I definitely have an interest in and a sensitivity to things relating to the Holocaust.
Yeah.
The civil rights movement, because I come from a left-leaning liberal tradition, and I was brought up to know about the civil rights movement and kind of to regard it as a modern or contemporary, almost contemporary, chapter in the history of the Enlightenment. And, you know, this attempt to that we have, albeit maybe not often enough, to rid ourselves of irrational prejudices and superstitions and to behave accordingly and therefore better, morally better, ethically better. And, you know, the civil rights movement is such a fantastic example of that and a fairly recent one, where really there isn't another side to it. You know, it's pretty clear which is the side of right. And the bravery and the ingenuity and the tenacity of the people involved makes it a pretty compelling story. And also, then again, the fact, you know, having spent so much time in the U.S., particularly New York, it was kind of, and this might make me sound very naive, but it was a bit of a shock to me, really, the extent to which race is still so important in the U.S. Somehow, I don't know, you know, growing up in Australia and being fed Sesame Street as a kid and, you know, coming from that kind of left-leaning liberal tradition, you think things are so much better. So it was a shock to become a kind of New Yorker, really, and realize, hey, these issues are still very much alive.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to actually also ask you about the Henry Border character. There actually was a figure named David Boder, minus the R, who did receive attention in the last 10 years. You cite in the sources, I did not interview the dead, but Boder, he collected 120 hours of testimony, also on a wire recorder, many of which can actually be found at a Voices of the Holocaust website. I spent some time there. He even wrote a thesis for his psychology master's at the University of Chicago called The Adjective-Verb Quotient. And I was, like, shocked by this. How did you discover David Boder, and why did you feel compelled to add an R to his last name and fictionalize him? I mean, can this Boder facsimile compete with the real thing? What of this?
Oh, well, I can answer that quite easily. I discovered the character of David Boder from the fabulous This American Life program.
Uh-huh.
I was in New York, and at that stage, I don't think I had moved there yet. I was just finishing off Seven Types of Ambiguity, and I heard this segment on This American Life on the radio, and I knew immediately, and sometimes this happens, and not often enough, I thought, I'm going to be writing about this, because I heard a man speaking English, having just interviewed a woman that was a Holocaust survivor at a time before the term Holocaust had been coined. He'd gone to a DP camp on his own money, and he'd interviewed, as it turned out, you know, over 100 people. And he'd managed to keep this kind of scientific distance. He interviewed the people in the same manner all the time, and despite the horrific nature of what he was hearing in many different languages, he managed to keep this detached demeanor. And it wasn't until his very last interview that he lost his reserve, he lost his detachment, and the woman that he's interviewing had broken off into sort of paroxysms of tears. And he says, I guess to himself, really, onto the wire recording, and this is a very, very new technology in 1946, which he only had by virtue of working in the building next to the guy that developed it at the Illinois Institute of Technology. This man says, who is going to stand in judgment over all this? And who is going to judge my work? And I heard this, and I thought, I understand the question, who is going to stand in judgment over all of this? Because he's reporting on a hell that's been, it's almost inconceivable. But when he says, who is going to judge my work? I thought, what is this guy guilty about? Why is he guilty? Why is there guilt dripping from his voice? And then, of course, you learn that he's a European Jew. And it's an attempt to answer this question. I thought one of the things that this novel will do is answer the question, why is this guy so guilty? Now, why did I fictionalize him? I did this with all the characters that are historically important. The things that happened in the middle of the 20th century, both in the U.S. and in Europe, are all based on things that actually happened. But I fictionalized the characters' names because I want to go into their minds, and I want to tell you what they're thinking, and sometimes the precise details of their actions, their activities, that I couldn't possibly know. Mm-hmm. And so in order to do that, I need to create the character, because I don't think it would be right or fair for me to tell you what real people were thinking, because I couldn't possibly know. I know occasionally novelists do that. I wouldn't be comfortable doing that. So what I will do is, for example, take the professional activities of the man David Boda and give them to my fictional character Henry Border. And so all sorts of things happened to him that didn't necessarily happen, particularly in the private life of David Boda, and I'm free to conjure a story and a backstory and a front story for Henry Border. So that's why I take, and this is the truth, this is the same, you know, device and rationale for so many of the characters that exist in the mid-century parts of the novel.
But it does raise an interesting question, because you're taking David Boder's wire recordings, which were discovered roughly around 1999, promoted by This American Life, and you have Adam discovering Border's recordings relatively later. And in thinking about this discrepancy, I wondered while I was reading the book, well, is this paying proper respect to what David Boder did, or is this... I mean, it raises a very interesting ethical question. I mean, I it may not necessarily be that important of an ethical question, but it does firmly plant your novel into fiction. It does firmly guide your universe into something that is created by Elliot Perlman, as opposed to something that is a response to the events that are around you. So, I mean, how do you negotiate that interesting balance?
Well, I don't really have a problem with it at all. I interviewed the woman she's the head of psychology at IIT, at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Mm-hmm. I interviewed the woman who found them, and we talked about this. And I interviewed some of Boda's students. They were in their 80s, and they were doing their master's on the adjective verb quotient. And I told told them. I told everybody that I was going to take his professional experiences and fictionalize them into a character. I think the problem would be if I were indeed saying that this is David Boder and this is what he thought and this is what he did, and that would be a dangerous ethical line to cross, I think, for me. But
why so?
And at the back of the book, I do tell people, you know, which characters are based on which people, particularly, you know, Boder and also the character Rosa, who's very important.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there's a whole list of sources at the back of the book to encourage people if they want to know more about these people. And in fact, you know, the Voices of the Holocaust website that comes from IIT, which is where the reader can find through the internet recordings, the recordings that Boder made. I list that at the back of the book, so I'm very clear. I would like people to know more about it,
mm-hmm.
And I understand there is an academic in the English department at Cambridge University in the UK who told me that there's some scholar, some academic that is writing. Either it's writing or has written, I'm not sure where they're up to now, a biography of the real David Boder. So, you know, I think the distinction is an important one. I'm definitely a novelist, and I'm creating a character who has had some of the experiences that David Boder had, but then there's someone else in another part of the world that's writing his best attempt to tell you exactly what the real David Boder did, and I guess to attempt to explain the motivations behind his behaviour. I don't have to guess at them because I've created my own character, so I can tell you what they are, and without worrying that I've got it wrong for David Boder, because I'm not writing about David Boder, I'm writing about Henry Boder.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to also ask about certain parallels and commonalities that are often in your work. Lamont's fate near the end of the book is centered around whether or not he has pilfered a menorah. And while this incident mimics the early episode involving the Shogun warrior at the very beginning, what's interesting is that much of the efforts to defend Lamont against these charges, they're related around hearsay and his ability to recite certain historical details about Heinrich Mandelbrot, the character, the old guy he meets at the hospital. Similarly, I couldn't help but notice certain commonalities between Simon Haywood, the teacher in Seven Types of Ambiguity, and Adam, the failed professor in The Street Sweeper. You have both characters, Simon kidnapping Anna's son, totally irrational, and you have Adam killing the relationship because he believes that Diana won't stand by him as he faces this questionable prospect of tenure. So there's this sort of really unusual emotional thrust that guides these characters, and I thought Diana was actually quite patient. But I wanted to talk about this. I mean, can you, when you're dealing with a big novel, avoid this, avoid parallels, or do these help to guide the reader and also the author into being tied into the inherent cyclical nature of existence?
Question. I don't really worry about it as I'm writing about it. I don't really worry about the parallels between characters as I'm writing about it. It's only after I've written and the book comes out that somebody like your good self will point them out to me, and I find that really interesting. And I do wonder about the similarities between Adam and Simon, and indeed Eddie in $3, my first novel.
Yeah.
I guess they are men who are in a state of crisis in their, you know, young adult years to I guess early middle age, and I suppose it's me as an author trying to imagine characters that are in certain respects not too far away from myself, at least maybe not according to what they do, but in the sense of their worldview. And, you know, you're trying to answer the question, how the hell do you live? How do you live ethically and successfully and in a way that you can not hurt people and sort of survive, you know, quite a time of change in the Western world, particularly recently. And so I guess I'm taking somebody with my values and putting them in a particularly dramatic thought and seeing what I make of it. And that might be what Eddie, Simon and Adam have in common. Adam, it's not so much that he's worried that his partner Diana won't stand by him, but he thinks in this possibly mistaken attempt to be chivalrous that if he's in a terrible way and can't support a child, that he shouldn't have a child until everything's perfect for him, until, you know, the optimal circumstances have arisen, and his partner thinks that's crazy. And if the relationship's going well, they should, you know, have a child and deal with their life afterwards rather than deal with their life first and then have a child. And it's because of his history with particularly his father, who essentially, you know, his father was one of those great men that's a terrible parent. You know, you get certain people that do things that are incredibly admirable, and we're glad those people exist, but you wouldn't want to be their spouse or their child, because they're just not there for you. So in certain senses, he's very much abandoned by his father. And because of that, I think it shapes him in a way that might look to the reader like it's illogical. And, you know, pretty soon he comes to feel that it's not a rational decision that he's made either. And much of the book he spends missing Diana and regretting what he's done. So, you know, and I guess in a sense also with Simon in Seven Types of Ambiguity, the irrational act of trying to get his ex-girlfriend's attention by, just for a moment, you know, for an hour or two, taking her son without permission.
Yeah.
And giving him a glass of chocolate milk and letting him play with his dog. That's nuts. You know, that's really nuts.
Yeah.
And not to be, I'm not approving of it, but it's a moment where a character that has values of which I approve does something that's irrational and that is going to hurt them. And I guess dramatically I find that of interest, because it doesn't matter how well thought through your philosophies are, you know, we are, we're frequently, our thought processes are driven with emotion. And as an Australian poet said here, the mythical Ern Mallin said, the emotions are not skilled workers. And so we, you know, however wise we think we are and however rational we think we are, we screw up because suddenly we're not thinking, because we're dripping with emotion.
Yeah. But also, emotions seem to propel these characters into near madness and, as you say, heightened anxiety. I mean, I was thinking about the whole situation with Adam and Diana's voice, which inhabits Adam's Morningside Heights apartment. And not just because I did live at Morningside Heights at one point. It was more because of just like, wow, you have to invent this fictive construct rather than confront the very reality before you. And the great irony there is that, of course, it does take voices recorded from reality to awaken him out of his stupor. I'm curious about this heightened fantastical notion, probably the most fantastical notion within this book, and how that developed. Did you feel that the book needed some counterweight against the very tough reality of Auschwitz and the like, or was this sort of a natural buttress point that came from Adam's crazed emotional state?
Well, there is that. And I'm really delighted that you pointed it out, the counterbalance between the voices that Adam discovers that Henry Border had discovered or made. Henry Border had recorded them. And these voices are literally being rescued, you know, from out of the valley of the shadow of death, you know. And that sort of sits beside or is even juxtaposed with voices, a voice, Diana's voice, which isn't really her voice, it's just his imagination, his imagining of her voice. So, yeah, there advice, if you want to call it that. And I'm delighted that you sort of saw the two sitting side by side. But then the other thing is, I don't know. I mean, so much of our time is spent in our own thoughts, and you can have mental conversations with people that aren't there anymore, either because you've lost somebody that you care about who's no longer living, or it's a relationship and you're not in touch with that person anymore, but you knew them so well and you knew what they'd be thinking when you do this or when you do that. And you can smile to yourself, you know, I know I'm doing that again, you know, I know you never liked it. It's, you know, it's like ending a long-term relationship and the first morning that you're apart, you go and make them, you make two large cups of coffee because that's what you used to do, and then you drink the other one because, you know, they didn't like waste. It's I don't know, it might be pathetically romantic of me, but I can well imagine that, you know, that you, in his case, he's probably, I don't think he's getting too close to actual psychosis, but it's a mental conversation. In a sense, the very best of her is still with him, and it's the very best of her that propels him out of his stupor and leads him to have some kind of chance of saving his personal and his professional life.
But he also has the student with the jet black hair. I mean, that the thing that was bizarre about that was just the obsession with the jet black hair. Every time she showed up, jet black hair, jet black hair. I mean, what was up with that? The aesthetic notion of this student. I mean, it goes from something that could have been an inappropriate relationship to something that becomes a, I suppose, barely legal relationship when she's working in the bar. But I mean, that's a very curious notion that the only thing that will save him is the Holocaust.
It's not the Holocaust saving him, or even the civil rights movement saving him, but his work saving him, in a sense, and getting him to wise up, you know. I mean, often if you're coming through some bad relationship, breakup, or any kind of emotional turmoil, it's being forced by the exigencies of everyday life to behave in a certain way, you know, that will get you through it. I mean, you just take the first steps in a, you're going through the motions of living like a person that's okay and that's healthy and that's not falling apart. And you do that for a while until some of the time you actually feel like that person, the person that is okay and is able to live and is not falling apart. And then gradually the proportion of your time where you're faking it and the proportion of your time where you actually are okay, it starts to change, and you're more and more okay. And I think that Diana's voice is incredibly helpful in getting him to be okay. And as far as that student with the jet black hair is concerned, well, you know, she had her own story.
Yeah.
And actually, she's an example of somebody I wanted to write more about, and I just realized I can't tell everybody's story, otherwise the book will, you know, be way too long. So that's an example of doing research where you have to let things go.
Yeah. Well, speaking of letting things go, and on the subject of voices, I think that your voice has been very helpful to elucidating aspects of your book. But Elliot, thanks so much. It was a great pleasure to chat with you.
Absolutely. It was a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Cool.
If I represent the one that did this to me, get up, stand up, get up, stand up, get on it.